All right, let's try that again. We'll see if we can So we're going to review the documentary, The Source Family, which we just watched on Prime for your first time, but for my second, I watched it during when it first came out during early pandemic. Go for it.
Well, what I noticed, because it started, although it said a few things about his earlier life, it was very brief, and it started with the opening of this restaurant, I think Sunset Boulevard in L.A., and it was interesting to note as an astrologer that he has his son in Cancer, July 4th birth date. So he's a man. Cancer rules nurturing and caring, a lot of the maternal qualities which men can embody beautifully, because they have no problem when it's a man with a Cancer son showing their feelings. So he's got the experience to be able to start a restaurant, and he's doing what a Cancer person does, which is to feed people, to nurture them. And he can do the big picture part, which is to put it together in terms of a restaurant rather than just around the kitchen table. And he also, within that, wants each individual person, like a member of a family, to feel recognized, loved, and seen. And that was illustrated very clearly throughout all of this, and nicely documented, that he would hug people and was very tactile. And certainly in the early days, it seemed fairly innocent, that he just wanted to be affectionate and let people know that he was an authority figure, certainly, but a nurturing and a caring and completely committed to each individual's unique spark kind of parent figure. And that was beautifully shown in the early stages of this. So as an astrologer, I found that quite fascinating. And of course, I remember those times because that was my my time of being in my late teens, early 20s. So if I had been inclined in that way, I can certainly see why people were drawn to it. People who came out of the 1950s structured, controlled, emotions completely subjected to being suppressed, and relationships that were completely stereotyped. You know, the man went to work, the woman stayed home, and they didn't share feelings or thoughts or anything. And so that generation, when it came to late teens, early 20s, what it wanted more than anything was a family that had connection.
So it was like a fatherless generation.
Well, fatherless and motherless, too, in that the mothers, although they were there in the home, their role was extremely rigid. They weren't allowed to move outside of their role. So women in the 50s who were not actually well suited to having children could be pretty difficult people to live with. They're unhappy. They could be completely miserable, and they could be even worse than that. They could be abusive because they don't want to be at home with kids. They had no choice. The birth control was virtually non-existent, and they didn't have any ability to go and earn a living. So they had to marry, they had to get someone who could support them, and then they had to keep him. So they had to play a role to make sure that the man didn't wander away. So the kids growing up in that environment, the father away working and not expressing any emotion or being involved with the kids, the mother at home but perhaps not wanting to be there. Some certainly didn't want to go to work, but some of them very much would have preferred a different life as an educated person or as a person especially earning their own money. So that generation coming out of that, they wanted to have freedom. They wanted to have the ability to do whatever it is they wanted to do. They wanted to find their creative spark, and they wanted to have relationships where people were honest, you know, in your face, completely affectionate, caring, but telling you the truth. Like, people from that generation were starved for the truth, were starved for a sense of connection. So Jim Baker came along, and he created a family dynamic, where people were told they were loved, they were wanted, they were special, and he created a place where you fed people, and everyone lived together in close quarters, so there would be a lot of affection and touching and just a feeling
love.
That you are loved, you are cared for, and also the encouragement to follow your creative spark, at least in the earlier stages. I don't know what extent that would be encouraged if your creative spark wanted to take you elsewhere. So that, I think, wasn't really addressed much in the documentary. That if people wanted to leave, were they encouraged to just follow their heart if that's what they wanted, or if pressure was brought to keep them there? That was something that really wasn't addressed, and that would have been interesting to have some insight into that.
Yeah, like when the dad wasn't allowed to give his son antibiotics because they were anti-medicine and they were shining light on the kid to try and cure him. And so he left, but it's unclear if he even brought his son with him.
Yes, if the mother was in the family, then very, very likely he wouldn't have, because it certainly wouldn't have been part of his background that the men
take the children.
Don't
tell you what happens to the kid.
Yeah, I'm sure the kid was okay, or they would have said something. They wouldn't have highlighted a child and then not said if the child had come to harm. Mm. But the child was lucky in that case and didn't lose its hearing. So,
yeah.
Yes.
So Jim Baker in 69, he had been fought in the Second World War. Then he robbed banks. He was a beatnik, was married, robbed banks, killed a couple guys in self-defense, and started the Source restaurant, which I didn't realize when I was, you know, I was, of course, raised by you and Dad or watching Woody Allen movies, and I didn't realize that famous scene in Annie Hall was actually a real restaurant. I thought it was just a thing Woody Allen made up to make fun of California, but it was the Source restaurant, that scene in Annie Hall where he orders what compressed yeast.
I'll
have an order of compressed
mashed
yeast. So Jim Baker reinvents himself as Father Yehoah, and gives everyone magical names, with their last names all being their last names as the Aquarian, their middle names is the. Most of them changed it legally, it seems, and a lot of these people are still around. But Jim Baker himself, Father Yud, lasted basically from 69 till what, 78, when he went hang gliding, and that was that.
Was it 78?
So that he
no,
was around
I think
for
it
8
was
years
75.
In total.
And then he died, and then they disbanded over 2 years.
They were around
you might
for
want
eight,
to check,
8 years, yeah.
Check that. But yes, 75 is a year when things started to become again more conservative, because the pendulum always swings. So one of the things that was going on astrologically was that Uranus was going through, let me find that, going through Libra, I believe, causing upheaval in people's perception of relationships. And that certainly was a big factor in that time, because it went from you had to be a virgin and you had to find a husband for women, and men you had to marry a virgin, and you had to marry and raise a family and get a job whether you liked it or not. And that was very much seen in Uranus in Libra, which Libra is the seventh house of marriage, and Uranus comes along, and that planet just turns everything upside down and sideways. It just brings chaos in its wake, and that chaos is usually ultimately in many ways for the best, because it gets rid of anything that is calcified, anything that has become rigid, and in a sense, once things become too rigid, then they become fragile and can break. So it sometimes things, the status quo needs to break and something new needs to come in. So that is what happened during that phase. As soon as birth control became something that women could easily get access to. Once there was the pill, then all of a sudden, very quickly, women were wanting to have sex and no longer had to marry because they were pregnant. And there was a lot of, with the bra burning and all the rest of women wanting to get out there and have a job, have a career, no longer having to be dependent on men no longer having to take on the responsibility of a family in a 9-to-5 job. And you see that exemplified in those people. I mean, they certainly went for a certain amount of regimentation with the same, wearing the same drapey clothes, but partly that too would really play into the whole, we're part of a family, we are identifiable and recognizable as a group that is committed to each other, and that kind of like a badge that they would have this wear the same type of clothes, and that they were free and flowing.
Yeah,
and
the uniformity of their dress to me doesn't suggest Aquarianism as I'm familiar with it. Would you say that the family overall represent more of an Aquarian energy or a Piscean one?
There's Aquarius involved astrologically around that time, and Aquarius is a group dynamic, and groups are very much known for taking something that makes them feel special, feel separate from other people, feel in some way that it identifies their group identity, and that group identity is different from everyone else. So the clothes, very much, I mean, they were not very different from a lot of the other clothes that were being worn at the time. I remember having a tie-dye, you know, full-length dress that I wore all the time, and it was out of India, and it was flowing and beautiful, and I loved wearing it. And they had the same clothes because they had a group identity, and they were comfortable in it because it was, you could look at each other and say, yes, this is my brother, this is my sister, this is my lover, this is my friend, and there's our dad over there who loves us so much, given us a job and an identity, and they focused in on the spirituality very, very quickly as he brought it in from his connection with the Swami. I can't remember his name, but he took what he wanted from that and then took other ideas from other spiritual paths, but the emphasis being on the spirituality of it.
Yogi Bhajan.
Yeah, not just on using it to control people, but using it, his intention obviously was to help people become more who they should be, more of their own creative inner light, and more conscious, and clearly adopted that part of the evolutionary part, the reincarnation, you're going to expand your consciousness aspect that came out of the East. It's not part of the that current Christian tradition. Certainly part of the mystical Christian tradition, but not part of the church on every corner tradition that most of us in the 50s grew up with.
Yeah. So, you were born in 1948, which means you were like 1920 in 69 when the Source family started. So you were of, this is definitely your generation.
Yeah, it's my generation.
Of boys and girls who were seeking whatever they were seeking. And of course maybe you would have, even if you had lived in LA, been with this group, but you were not into the drugs at all. You were very anti-drugs and alcohol.
I wasn't anti-drugs or anti-alcohol. I just would found that for me, physiologically, I react very, very strongly to taking things like that. So the one time I tried hashish, it took me 3 days to come down. So it was just not something that suited me. I also prefer my mind to be clear. I don't want to go someplace off on a a trip in my head, and I just wasn't as trusting in terms of believing that someone else could open my consciousness. So I certainly had the opportunity to do LSD, even a controlled trip. I know people who did it under the guidance of a psychiatrist, which is the smart way to do it if you were
in
those days.
And this was back in
days, the 70s.
Late 60s.
Yeah, people were doing it that way. People were doing it on their own, and some of them were jumping off buildings. So that never struck me as a very good idea because I thought, well, I definitely could be one of those people who might decide flying is a terrific idea.
I've been at the beach when someone's jumped off the cliff on that stuff, and thought they could fly, and helicopters had to air carry them out because it was out the cliffs at UBC. But you found Maharishi anyway. You found your own path, other than, I'm not comparing Father Yod to Maharishi exactly, but
not at all. Very different.
Yeah. Tell me.
Well,
for a lot of people who they would seem like the same sort of thing, you know, they both are. Guys with big beards driving Rolls Royces with leading people spiritually. In very broad stroke terms.
Yeah, so we'll just walk that back a little bit.
Go for it.
First of all, Maharishi never drove. So
well, of course,
if he was in a car, I don't know what type it would be, but someone else would drive for him. He was out of a very ancient 2,000-year-old Vedic tradition in India, and came up through the path of meditation and denial of an ascetic life. He was a monk. So he had his degree in physics, a bachelor's degree in physics, but then he met someone who became his teacher, Guru Dev, and he took on the life of an ascetic, a monk.
So that's slightly different than being a bank robber who opens up a hippie cafe.
Somewhat, yes.
Not to diminish Father Yod and the Source family, of course.
Well, Father Yod, Jim Baker, was on his personal path. He created his own spiritual journey, and he invited everyone to join him on it. It was just part of his personal nature to want to have other people around him and to include them on his journey. So whether or not that change happened, can't remember the details from the documentary. So whether it was just doing a specific drug or
mushrooms.
Several.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that it opened up his
well, that
mind.
Was at the end there, right? We were talking about that. So, like, here's something. Just let me get this thought out. So, you know, what's interesting to me, the reason I even brought up Maharishi, besides the fact that that was your path that you chose in those years in the 70s, you became a transcendental meditation practitioner, and I grew up in a Maharishi world, so that was definitely the path you chose.
Yeah, not till 19... I started meditation in 1972, so I was involved
that's
in other things before then.
That's what I'm saying. So the parallels are spiritual leaders and a community of people that they're leading. That's the parallel I'm drawing. Those are the parallels. It's broad because it's necessarily broad, but that's what's interesting about it is what kind of environment and what kind of teachings those teachers bring into those environments and what goes on with those people. That's what's interesting to me.
Okay, well, I don't really want to draw. I can tell you some of the differences. The obvious one being, as I said, that Maharishi was a monk from India, part of a very ancient 2,000-year-old tradition, and he came to the West to teach meditation to anyone in the West who was interested in learning.
I'm not interested
so
in
comparing
them.
So it's not really. They're very, very different. So the fact that they had beards and wore flowing clothes just is a very superficial comparison. And I think what was very interesting about Jim Baker is that you have a very strong personality, and who is on his own spiritual journey, which he did in a way that included about 140 other people, at least, because people came and went, on that journey with him. That's a very interesting, organic scenario where everybody joined together and wanted to create something spiritual and true for themselves.
Yeah, what I found interesting was, you know, unlike, so, you know, it, with Maharishi and a lot of spiritual gurus and teachers, you have them leading people and pointing them towards a practice and God, right? This is a, here's a practice, this will connect you with God. Like, pray to God. If you meditate, you connect with God. Whereas Jim Baker was God. He was God. He was directing people not to something beyond him so much, but to himself for most of the Source family. And certainly that's what the impression I got from the documentary. But then he had a big change when they're in Hawaii. They did that ritual with eat a big bowl of mushrooms each, and he told them, I'm not God. And they all freaked out. They, some of them left and renounced him, which is probably what you should do when someone tells you they're not God. That's sort of what they're telling you to do, is renounce them. But that's, so that's interesting, because like you were saying, he brought them on his journey. First he was God, they worshipped him as God, and then he realized fundamentally through plant medicines that he wasn't. He had his own revelation on the psilocybin, and told his followers that he wasn't God, and he was just a man, and they freaked out. And then he prepared himself for death, because he was predicting his own death, saying, I'm ready to go, and you all have to go on your way.
Yes, that's an interesting synopsis of what happened, for sure. Again, the difference with Maharishi was that he was, although a monk himself, he wasn't preaching anything to do with his religion. He wanted to offer meditation as a technique to Westerners, because he didn't perceive that they had anything, or that he perceived that they would benefit from a technique twice a day just to relieve stress. It was absolutely not focused on preaching anything about reaching God. People who wanted to become teachers of TM and delved more into the roots of the practice, I think those people had more of a spiritual bias and an interest. But people around the world who were doing TM did it as marketed predominantly as a way to reduce stress. And a lot of scientific research was done, some of it at Harvard, very good studies, just simply showed that physiologically, the practice of meditation using a mantra would enhance your physiological health, reduce blood pressure, and other physiological values would become healthier. So it was a very, very different. I mean, they're just not people I would compare as being similar in any way, except the most superficial. The Maharishi was not building a family or...
No, I wasn't. You know, I didn't compare them, right?
I don't know what you mean by that.
It just seems a little that you're thinking I was comparing them, but I wasn't. I'm not comparing them at all.
Okay, well, I don't know why you mentioned... Well, I don't know...
I was talking about your spiritual... You being the same age as the people who joined that family, but you joined... You know, you went with Maharishi. You didn't join a group like that. You joined a different group. I wasn't saying reading into it at all. I was just highlighting.
Except that their group started to break up around the time.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about, is the documentary and what happened in that and that sort of thing. So, I don't want to talk about TM or anything, or Maharishi at all.
I agree. I don't think it's comparable. It's
not at all. Not at all.
Spirituality is a factor in any meditative practice if you wish to focus on it, but it can be just used as a way to relax and become more open and more effective in your life. And in the beginning with the Source family, Jim Taylor was portraying himself as their father, as a parent figure, providing them with a family environment. And then later he became, well, getting rather fond of himself and decided he was God. And I got the impression that he was sincere about it. So whatever his experiences through the spiritual practices of breathing and movement and drugs that he was using, I think he really sincerely, it sounds like he sincerely came to that place where he saw himself as God.
And now, a word from our sponsors. Well, we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated. We thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week, or $6 a month, or $50 for the year. It helps a lot. Plus, you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
Whether he actually thought, well, I'm a part of God, so that makes me God, or how he conceptualized it, he did go to that place where he started calling himself God, which gets a little dicey.
Yeah, and he was assigning women to men, telling women, you can't be with the guy you're with anymore. You have to be with Mercury over here.
Yeah, so that gets a little dicey.
That's very Jehovah.
He went from being a nurturing father figure with a loving family to getting sort of delusions of grandeur, godier, and then controlling people's lives, and then into a very disturbing range where he was basically just wanted to have sex with a lot of young women, and that was a very negative stage of that development. But then he did come out of it at the end, and he did recognize that he wasn't the God. You know, he might be a part of God, but he wasn't the God. He's a man. He's a person. And he really did go on quite a full journey, and a lot of people came along with him, and it's interesting that those people were really attracted to his journey and being a part of it with him. It's a fascinating study of that whole dynamic. It's like they became all cells within one life form almost. And then he finished with it. You know, very sincerely, he said, I'm not God. That's not the case. I'm just a man. And then he was ready to leave. So that was really quite a really beautifully done documentary, in that it showed his spiritual path. And you don't very often get to see someone's spiritual path laid out so clearly, all the way from, you know, a normal American childhood through fighting in wars, being married, getting involved in some very sketchy activities, and then really turning to a spiritual path and going through it with a whole group of people that he took on a journey with him. And then he ended it, and then they all dispersed because it was over. That journey had ended.
Yeah. I think, yeah. He had, what, 13 wives, but only one legal one, Robin. And she really got destroyed by him when he decided to. He had his commandments, right, that everyone followed, and one was monogamy and one man, one woman. Then he changed that to decide to have 13 wives and threw over his main wife, and she described him after that as a dirty old man on a lust trip.
Yeah, and that's pretty accurate from the sounds of things.
Yeah, plus not to mention the fact that some of those wives were under very 18 young. In the States,
very,
which is
very young.
Illegal, I guess. Back then they lost members over it, so I assume that was, I know different states, we're Canadian, right, so we don't have a clue, but I know different states have different ages of consent, but he had, and so, but some of the members left at that time, so it must, their age of consent must have been 18 back then, but I don't know, I was not around in the 70s.
There is something where parents or legal guardian can give you permission to marry, and it's possible that some of those young women were able to get that permission. I have no idea, because they don't exactly explain how he was able to marry those people, or if he even tried to marry them legally.
He didn't.
If what they actually just did was their own ceremony, and they would be, in that sense, perhaps better described as concubines. But his wife in the documentary was very clear how extremely disturbed and distressed she was
by him
going off the path, and it was written all over her face. She's anguished. But torn, obviously, because she still loved him. She had children with him. And but
she,
you could see
there
that
while he was,
she could see that she didn't believe in what he was doing, and she didn't believe he did either, which was a very telling point.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't buy into his, well, gee, I'm God and I can do whatever I want. You know, where have we heard that one before?
Yeah.
You know, it's the dirty old man excuse. So, but he did travel through that phase and come out the other end. And it seems as though he recognized that he was not an all-powerful being who could do whatever he wanted. We don't know if it actually went that far, but he certainly recognized, oh, okay, I am actually kidding myself on this one. I'm just an ordinary person. I'm not the deity.
Do you think at the end there, when he decided to do that basically suicidal flight... without experience or training, do you think it was part of that? Might have been that realization, and then the shame of some of the, you know, the his sins, so more or less, and
no.
desire, like sort of. But you know, you don't want to just jump off a cliff for, in front of your followers, so you hang glide off the cliff. You don't think that was going on?
I believe he was sincere in his journey.
It really does seem so.
Believe. I didn't get the impression from what they showed us, and that's pretty unique footage to have basically someone's last hours documented like that. It seemed he was very sincere, and I think he felt a sense that with that Latin phrase he used at the to the person who spoke to him.
We who are about to die salute you.
Yes, you know, so I think he felt, no, I'm done. I've come full circle. I've learned everything I can learn. And I think he was at that point accepting of whatever was next for him. But he had a feeling, obviously, that he was just finished. And in human terms, we often think of being finished as being mortal death. Doesn't have to mean that, but we do tend to feel, okay, I'm done, I'm ready to go. And certainly for someone with spiritual beliefs, the idea that his spirit was now ready to leave the body, because this particular adventure had run its course. And the documentary showed that, I think, quite beautifully and in a very intimate and touching way.
Yeah, so as we know, our friend Edward has had a lot of these people on his podcast, including Isis, who I think put this together. Plus, he was in a Hollywood office dealing with permits or something when she was doing it. And then, so other Aquarians were calling in trying to ask him if he knew about it because they wanted to stop it. And he's like, I don't remember the story. I think he told me about it on a podcast, but maybe not. We'll have to talk to him about it next time. But I'm really excited to talk to Zarathustra Aquarian on the podcast and find out, because I'm curious about the conflict around the documentary. I know they glossed over the ceremonial magic stuff in a way that is very suspicious, plus the really absurd imageries and video footage they put while discussing that and saying that they were practicing Golden Dawn sex magic techniques. Like, that's not true. That's a lie. So if you're lying about using Golden Dawn sex magic techniques, because there are no sex magic techniques in the entire Golden Dawn corpus.
And they wouldn't be gymnastic based.
And they wouldn't be involve hanging from monkey bars naked, swinging around making goofy faces. So something's going on there in the that part of the documentary. It's like it felt to me the first time like they're trying to cover up something. Either they're embarrassed about the ceremonial magic stuff because they did it in a really goofy and insincere and stupid way, so they want to portray it that way and demean it. Or maybe it made me think, this is just my reaction to the documentary, or it made me think maybe there was more going on. They were working with some serious entities and stuff like that, which I think could have, if they were, that could have led to his transformation and turnaround and death in sort of peace, you know, rather than like going out the way a lot of these cult leaders go out. And so I'm curious if they were covering up more serious magical stuff or connections, or they just don't say anything at all. The only thing they do say is in no way possibly accurate. And so that's really, of course, you know, running an occult podcast, I want to know more. Like, what happened there?
Well, I think what they portrayed was, as you say, they glossed over. They said certain things were being explored and then glossed over it and portrayed it with certain very goofy images that didn't match with the words. So I would say inquiring minds want to know. It would be a question of speaking with the historian, Isis, and seeing...
Well, she's the one who made that gloss
that's
happen,
what I'm
yeah.
Speaking right. with Isis and seeing off the record at first if there was a reason why she didn't reveal more of that information, because she has all the archives and she was there. And it would be nice to know from her on a person-to-person level if that's something she might be interested in revealing more of on a podcast that is more focused on the esoteric. And it may be that what I wondered was, this was a documentary for the masses, so perhaps she didn't want to delve into the more arcane practices. It's all speculation until you actually speak to Isis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I will, but
she's
certainly welcome to put on the podcast, as are any of the Aquarian Source family members who might hear about this. I'm talking to Zarathustra either tomorrow or Monday, hopefully. Who knows, maybe he'll hear this and be like, I'm not talking to that dude.
Well, hopefully he will. I mean, it would be very interesting just to talk to him and see what his experience was. This is one woman's experience, and she had the good fortune, and as did viewers, to have all this documentation. But there's also just nothing that compares with an individual's firsthand account of their experiences in what is, for most people, an extremely unique situation. And also one very rooted in that time period, because it's only the people who went through it, who were there, who know what really happened. And Zarathustra will have his unique take on it. And different people can be looking at the same, living through the same experience, and have completely different experiences of it and outcomes. So I'm so looking forward to, and it'll be so exciting to hear what Zarathustra's experiences were and what he's keen and willing to share.
Yeah. Well, that's one of actually what interests me the most about the Source family, is that given how young, a lot of them were teenagers when they joined, and this is just in the 70s, so what that means is a lot of them are still around. And what was interesting at the end is to see how many of them have gone on to do absolutely remarkable things. Like, the band has reformed, their band is still active, and that would be amazing to see. But just so many of these people who are have gone on, and like, some are in Washington just down the road from us, and some are part of Ramtha now, of course, and just some of them are, you know, made tens of millions on software. Just really interesting people, it seems, came out of it, who weren't, you know, they didn't all drink poison in a jungle, you know?
No, it didn't have
a very
that kind
different
of
story.
Really tragic outcome from someone who, the Jim Jones scenario you're referring to, who really became a megalomaniac, and people became sheeps, gave up their will. And I think Jim Baker, and I can't say his other names properly.
Father Yod.
So he wanted to, ultimately, and his most sincere wish appeared to be, to empower people to be who they are and to live in a positive way that does not hurt the environment or other people. I like what he said in the very beginning, and I think that perhaps he came full circle to that, which is simply be kind. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. Be kind to the earth. And some of the people at the end of the documentary, they showed how they were living their lives in a way that they hoped would be kind to themselves, others, and the earth.
Yeah, that's what's actually also really interesting, is a lot of the followers, a lot of the times in these cults, you know, people go and then they're like, oh, I can't believe I was a part of anything like that. They reject everything. So I see this tons in the Golden Dawn and groups like that, where it's like a lot of the magicians and adepts that came out of Temple Tehuti, like, you can't bring up magic or spirituality even, or religion at all, without them breaking down so much mentally that they have to go into a mental institute. I've had this experience with several past members. So it's like, well, I don't know what happened to you, but clearly you, I don't know. I don't even know. I can't even speak to it. I don't want to. Well, but like, to see, so these people have gone on and they're still living these ecological, you know, holistically minded, I don't know how, what's another good word for it?
I think holistic is a good word. You know, they are wanting to build sustainable environments that don't damage the earth. And I think that one of the big differences, if you come out of an order, an organization with certain practices, is not the same as the people who came out of an experience where they felt they were part of a family and they have taken on those values of loving and sharing and caring. Different route. And different root problems. And I wouldn't be presumptuous enough to speak to them because I'm not qualified. But the emphasis that Jim Baker had, that he started with, in which people were responding to, you can see the faces, you can see the joy and the happiness in what we've been allowed to see in this, which is people feeling loved and free and open. And not all of that would be drug-induced all of the time. So,
well,
there's a lot of sincerity.
It doesn't seem like
that.
They were heavy drug people at all. They were more just libertarian, it seemed, or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good word. But it was not artificially maintained.
Right.
Clearly,
yeah.
they were sincerely feeling a sense of being loved. And in the end, it didn't seem like he ever betrayed that.
Yeah.
He didn't turn on them. And although there was that
in-between, he didn't betray them as a group, but he betrayed some of them as individuals.
Absolutely. And he betrayed young women by wanting to have sex with them and marry them. Mm-hmm. That was absolutely a very serious betrayal. But
that's not a nice word
for
what
that is. Overarching umbrella of it was still that, you know, he wanted to be a loving person. He just got a little sidetracked into the lustful version of that. And, you know, people are willing to forgive a certain amount if the error is sincere, and certainly if it's recognized. And, you know, it seems like he wanted to apologize for that in his last speech, in saying, I'm not a god. He doesn't actually say, I'm sorry I said that before and made you all do things, but but he did say, you know, that's not the case. So I am just a man. And men and women make mistakes. So, and we can all understand and forgive it, especially when people will say, you know, mea culpa. It was, it's what I thought at the time, and now I know I was wrong.
Well, I guess that probably covers it, eh?
I think it does. It was a fascinating documentary and a really amazing slice of that time.
I told you it wasn't what you were expecting it was going to be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Was I right?
Yes, because it was certainly a more positive ending than is often the case in cult-oriented groups.
Yeah.
So this was basically benign and quite positive. I mean, we don't know about the experiences of people who were not in the documentary, so there might have been harm done to people who have issues, but, you know, that wasn't focused on this, and
Touched a little. It's actually, it did a good job of touching on like sort of the tips of the icebergs of potential bad things, but also of the good. It was very balanced. I thought it was balanced. And if I'm wrong, I would love to be.
Yeah, you know,
we'll find out with some interviews.
The lady who presented this ISIS, she was their archivist, so she has a sense of responsibility and commitment to present it in a way that I think she feels is honest, but is also positive. I do think she has that desire to present it in a way that explains it in a positive way.
Oh, I agree, which is what makes it even more interesting that we know from Edward that while she was in the process of doing that, because he was in the Hollywood offices, or LA film offices, that there was that many Aquarians were trying to stop her. And I'm curious, like, why? What was her agenda that they were trying to stop? Because I can't see it in the documentary. Maybe that's the point.
The point is, too, that if they're trying to stop her before she did the documentary, they didn't yet know how it was going to turn out. So what would be of equal interest then would be, how do they feel? How do these former members feel now that the documentary's out there and it's available to them to see? And they could do their own documentary, too.
Oh, for sure. It's very easy to do.
Yeah, or they could go on podcasts and just give their point of view, because everyone's going to have had a very different experience.
Yeah, the Esoteric Nerd podcast. Check it out, people, for my buddy Edward, very honored friend of BT's, many interviews with Isis the Aquarian, Zarathustra the Aquarian, Jin the Aquarian, Waterfall the Aquarian, I think. Anyway, you guys can go check it out. And stay tuned for very exciting stuff coming up. I've just a crazy slew of interviews coming up that's just going to be... I'm working hard at prep, let's put it that way, okay? So, yeah. Have a great weekend. Want to say bye, Mom?
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a 6-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.
Diving deep into the practices and reality tunnels of the esoteric and the occult, check out Praxis Behind the Obscure podcast, where I interview practicing occultists, do book reviews, and much more. Check us out on YouTube, Red Circle, and many other podcast platforms.